When it comes to hard work, there's one important rule. Pick the right tool for the right job. That's why Chevy offers a family of Silverado pickup trucks designed just for the job. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
You know, the most important election in I don't know how many years is happening right now. No, it's not the mayor's election. No, it's not the governor's election. The fat billionaire governor can still be governor. And the idiotic mayor can still have his panic attacks. No, I'm talking about another important election. This one for Cook County State's Attorney, the prosecutor. For years now, we've had Kim Fox, Juicy Smollett's girlfriend, the savior of criminals, and George Soros as the state's attorney. And of course, you've seen what's happened. Crime shooting through the roof. Murders, mayhem, violence on the trains, everywhere. Old ladies being attacked. I mean, this is just out of a dystopian nightmare, but it's not. It's out of Cook County in Chicago. And the campaign to elect the state's attorney is fundamental to that effort. Clayton Harris wants to continue the Kim Fox policy. He says, I see nothing wrong with following what she's done. I mean, madness. And, well, Jeff, you've got something for us to listen to here.
Yeah, John. I mean, we're living through it now, this idea of the redefinition of what crime is and what victims of crime are, right? In the Kim Fox universe and the Judge Evans universe, people who commit crimes are... You know, they're victims of the system. They're only committing crime because we've essentially have made what they do criminal. That's the kind of the idea. And I'm sure some of our listeners have probably seen this, but this popped up over the weekend. Black Men in America, The Road to 2024, this TV show, I believe it's on MSNBC.
Of course it is.
Yeah, of course. Al Sharpton and Ben Crump, the infamous, famous, however you want to call him, attorney, we're talking about this very thing and really put it into context and said it much better than I could.
We can get rid of all the crime in America overnight, just like that. And people ask how, Attorney Crump, change the definition of crime. Of course, if you get to define what conduct is going to be made criminal, you can predict who the criminal is going to be.
It sounds like we are criminal, though. Yeah. Our existence is
the culture.
Criminal.
They made the laws. They made the law to criminalize our culture.
To fit up.
Black culture. Mm-hmm. And so when I think of Eric Garner, I always think of stuff like that. Lucid cigarettes.
Guy lost his life.
Man. Yeah. And then George Floyd was trying to buy cigarettes and so forth. So you have to think about the profiling things that they come up with the profilers for. Pretext your reasons. And it happens every day, Al. They would come and say, you can't wear baggy pants.
Right.
Make that a crime.
Right.
You can't have milk cartons in your yard. Right. Make that a crime.
Right.
And they are arguing that crime is a black thing. It's a cultural thing.
Right. That crime is a white construct that to reinforce racism and keep black people down. And I mean, I've seen it in my life. That surely has happened in this country. There's no denying that. But is that what the problem that this country is facing right now, where people are getting, you know, shot in their own neighborhoods or robbed or their cars stolen at unprecedented levels? No, that's not what we're talking about here.
One of the true reasons, secret reasons that John Cass likes to do podcasts with Jeff Carlin is that they plant seeds that turn into columns. Like right now, I'm thinking of like, what could Sharpton do for a living once Kamala Harris is no longer giving word salads? And you know what it is? Go work. He can take Crump and they can work for Tony P, boss Tony Preckwinkle, because that's her philosophy too, right? Isn't it? And she's running the show, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've talked about this. Yeah, the criminal justice system in this country sure has got a checkered past, to say the least. And we, John, I know you and I've talked about this, but I'll speak for myself specifically. But do believe that there were certainly reforms that need to happen to keep people who, like they said, you know, the milk crates in their front yard or whatever it is, some stupid thing, and then they're stuck in a jail for weeks and months until they get a case, whatever. That stuff has to be fixed. But the idea that we need to tear it all off and it's all of it's a bad thing because it all started from there, not fixing it, is what they want to do. And we've seen this time and time again that they think these great thoughts, in quotes, and then there's no follow through or there's no, you know, idea of what happens next. I mean, we're living it right now with Brandon Johnson, who can't do anything right. I mean, the guy wants to change the whole world, but doesn't realize he's got to do small steps to make big change. And we're seeing it in real time that he says these things. He says these big world changing things. And then there's no follow through, like, you know, the shot spotter system. Oh, by the way, yeah, I did away with it. Well, did you tell them? Oh, well, you know, I didn't do it. You know, there's no forethought of anything.
I'm still stuck in the trying to make sense out of what Fonnie Willis and her father say, which is black people carry a lot of cash. I thought this was a Greek Italian thing, and now blacks are taking this thing over. I guess if you're a shopkeeper, if you're a peddler, if you run a fruit store, yeah, you do cash. But I just can't make heads or tails out of this whole.
Right.
I mean, when you say that crime is a black thing, I don't think that's really fair to all the people, black people that I know, who are legitimate, right, straight up and down, you know, right is right and wrong is wrong, and go to church on Sunday and not just say they're Christian, but actually study the Bible. And I, you know, like my friends, you know, that I know do that every Sunday. They sing in the church. While they're cooking Sunday dinner for the parish, they think about all this stuff, and they can't stand it when a bunch of white journalists start making excuses, because there are no excuses. You know, it's just sad. You know,
there are no excuses, but we do have a special guest this week that kind of steps us into this race. Cause for those who aren't in the know, you know, Chicago just opened last week, the early voting for the Cook County state's attorney, any of the primary. It's, we won't get into the weeds on how we do things here, but that started, and the election is less than a month away. And it's one of these elections that, you know, has just minuscule turnout compared to a general election.
That's what Boss Tony wants.
Unfortunately, that's what they want, because the people who are activated to vote in these primaries are activists themselves, usually. So it's very important. So John Gorman's our guest. John, you want to give us a little background on John?
Well, John Gorman's here not to talk about the state's attorney's race.
A little bit.
I want to make it clear to Tony P, Boss Tony P, because she'd take revenge out on all of Gorman's family, and he's not here to talk about the state's attorney contest. He wants to talk about his novel, Death Before Life. Yeah, and I've sent Jeff a copy of it. It's great. And John Gorman is the former city editor of the Chicago Tribune. He's the guy that, when I showed up for work that one day many years ago, the boss is Dick Ciccone, tank commander in Vietnam, said to John, a former Peace Corps volunteer and bartender throughout the South, throughout Asia, he said, John, find Cass a seat. And he did. It was my pleasure and honor to work with him, and it's our pleasure and honor to talk about this book, Death Before Life. I just love Chicago detective books, and this is a classic.
It is. It's a good one. And John comes from the background, which is of the state's attorney's office, having worked there, doing comms and such, and being a chief of staff. And he's got the insight. I mean, he's seen tons of stories and some really cool details. And John knows it better than I did, but John says it's touching. I mean,
they love the office. They're like the old warrior priests of old, you know, old. I mean, these are people, traditions of generations of people in that were part of Chicago. We just lost Jack Higgins the other day, and Pat Hickey on the Chicago, on the John Cass News, wrote a stunning and beautiful tribute to Jack Higgins and talked about how without the Catholic philanthropy, Chicago would never have rebuilt itself after the 68 riots. So get this book. You'll listen to the conversation with John Gorman. Get this book. It's a great read. And you'll get the next one, too. If you read this one, there's another one coming out.
Yeah, and there's no kickback here. We're not getting a piece of this. I know that's the Chicago way, but that's not the Chicago way here when we bring on authors. So please enjoy.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall-style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way, that's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Well, everybody, I'm sitting here with Jeff Carlin of WGN Radio. And me, John Cass, of johncassnews.com. And we're pleased to be joined by, I guess, the first guy I met at the Chicago Tribune many, many years ago. He's written a book, and I don't usually recommend books, but I did the other day on Twitter, and a few people wrote back and said they were going out to get it. Death Before Life, a Mike Halloran detective novel by John F. Gorman. Mr. Gorman, this is a great book, and I can't wait till the next one.
I have just finished the first draft. I brought it to a printer yesterday to print it out to find all my mistakes, because there's nothing like looking at a piece of paper to find your mistakes, right, John?
Yeah, well, especially when you're your own editor.
Yeah. You miss a lot. But it's about the same length, 70,000, similar thing. But I remember the day I met you too, John.
Tell me about it so that we can inspire the crowd.
Well, I was the Day City editor, so I got in about 7:30. And the managing editor who hired you, Dick Ciccone, had told me the day before that you were going to be coming in, and when you came in, to find a place for you to sit, and then when he got in a little after 9 or 9:30 to bring you in. And so that's just I went out and got you out of the reception, brought you in and sat you down at a desk. And it contrasts with the reception I got on my first day at the Tribune, when I walked up to a crusty old Day City editor and introduced myself, and he said, "Your fly is down." I said, "What?" He said, "Your fly is down." Welcome to the Tribune.
There you go.
Oh, that's fantastic. John, it's great to have you. For those who aren't familiar, tell us your story. Give us the we always like to do the bona fides, your Chicago bona fides. Where'd you begin?
Well, I grew up in the North Side. I went to St. Gertrude's Grammar School, Loyola Academy, Xavier University. I played basketball in high school and college. After college, I joined the Peace Corps, went to India, traveled for a couple of years, came back and thought I'd be a foreign correspondent. So I applied to City News Bureau, the old training ground, and started there, spent about 20 months, and then called up this Bill Jones, the city editor of the Tribune, and told him I was interested in the job. And he said, "When do you want to come in?" And the next day I was in Jones's office, and 26 years later, I left.
That's not the way I heard it.
What'd you hear?
Well, all right. I heard that there was a tough guy named John Gorman who was maybe not the best basketball player in the world, but had mean elbows, okay? and he was a big guy, 6'5", 6'6", at the time. and could move. And usually guys that large could not move. He should have probably become a wide receiver, but I don't think he was short enough for it then. And he gets into a fight in a bar in Milwaukee. And then later with his teammates. And then I guess some wise guy bar. And then later he gets into a fight on the basketball court with the, I guess, an All-American from Xavier University. And then the first thing Jones asked you was, did you get kicked out for fighting or something like that?
That's very close. He looked at my resume and he said, you started in 62 and you finished in 68. What took you so long? And I said, well, I got thrown out of school after my sophomore year. And Jones, who was an ex-Marine, says, no crap. What for? And I said, well, I got a fight in the gin mill in Milwaukee after the Marquette game. And then Xavier, then 2 months later, there was a fight against the Cincinnati. And I punched Ron Bonham, Cincinnati's All-American. And June rolled around, and Xavier wasn't interested in having me as a student or an athlete anymore. So Jones scratched his tattoo and says, that's great. And then 7 years later, after Jones had died, probably not long after you got there, John,
right.
I was talking to Chuck Mount, an old Tribune reporter, and I was talking about
Chuck.
I was talking about Jones, and he said, yeah, he was a great guy. You know, he was a hellraiser in college. I said, oh, shit. And he said, yeah. You know, he got thrown out of University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee because he got in a fight in a bar in Milwaukee. And I thought, good Lord, I never heard that before. So, in effect, Jones was looking across the desk at himself. And he hired me, and, you know, it wasn't because I was a great writer or a great reporter when I was 27 years old. But it was, I was his kind of guy, so to speak.
Well, there were people like that who actually lived lives before journalism. They didn't just go graduate school, then journalism, like little lemmings, you know. I mean, they had lives. And that I've always felt that I guess that's sort of what they would call blue collar now. Oh, God forbid, you know.
Yeah.
But it's like building a house. It's a trade, not an art form, and I never got around to impressing that on enough people that counted at the paper, the ones who did the hiring. But you had a life, John, and you can see it in all your work, in your coverage of all these stories. You covered crime. You were the city editor for many years, and you were my boss, and you were also fair. But then you went on to work at the state's attorney's office for Dick Devine for years after that. And at that time, I saw newspapers changing not for the better, but for the worse, because we got into a kick now where everyone who was on death row had to be innocent and everyone who was a criminal had to be released. And anyone arrested was, I don't know, hurt by systemic racism or whatever the hell they call it. It wasn't just a barbarian who bashed the old lady's head in with a mallet. He was a victim of something. Yep. And we, again and again, on and on, and you persevered in the in that job with state's attorney Devine. And I have to say, John, I don't think I was very fair to Mr. Devine because, well, I was mad about, you know, I was pissed off about Rich Daley, but then I brought up to the Tribune reporters, why are you guys going after Dick Devine for all these for these cases? Like, you have to redo these wrongs. It wasn't Devine. Rich Daley was the state's attorney, and one of the reporters at the Tribune turned to me and said, "John, you don't understand. Rich Daley's the mayor, and he's not really all that involved in what happened at the state attorney's office. And I thought, okay, so you already have, you couldn't, in, back in the day, you couldn't even get away with that kind of thinking. Like, I've done, I've got my, the end of my story. Now I just have to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
But that's what happened, Jen. So anyway, that's my view.
Yeah. Well, it's your, what you say kind of segues into the reason I wrote that book. You remember, John, in 82, George Ryan was the governor, and he was in trouble. He was about to get indicted. He had stories almost daily about his involvement in the bribe scandal with the Secretary of State's office when he was Secretary of State. So Ryan decided he was going to let all have some clemency hearings for all 150 guys on death row. Horrible people. Horrible people. Committed horrific crimes.
But he put them all through it. He put the victims through hell again. I don't understand. I didn't get it.
Yeah.
For himself.
There was a little girl who was 6 years old when Lawrence Jackson invaded their home to drug beef, and he killed this girl's mother and aunt and sister and two other relatives and stabbed this little girl 47 times, and I'm prepping her for her testimony in the hearings, and now she's 21.
Oh God!
Holding her hand, and she's telling me this story. It breaks your heart, and so we went through that travesty, as you say. George Ryan had already made up his mind what he did, but he put those people through that trauma, you know, ripped off that emotional scab off of all these families. And then let everybody off death row anyway. Shame on him.
Well, he didn't leave them all. He got one that deserved it. I remember because he was a kid reporter then. And he was this assailant criminal was Greek. His name
Kokoralis.
Yeah, Kokoralis. He was a man burner and a psycho. And it was time to put him down, and he did.
Yeah, and that was 1999. And so I didn't bother George's conscience then, but 3 years later, when he was in trouble, he was currying favor with the Tribune and the others in the press. So it was an awful 2 weeks that these poor families went through.
You're listening to John Gorman, former city editor, the Chicago Tribune, and spokesman for this Cook County State's Attorney's Office. He's written a novel, Death Before Life, and I recommend it highly. I will write about it, and we're talking about it now. So you can get it on Amazon, where I got mine. Are you still working with Amazon? Are they doing the next book, John?
Yeah. Amazon just lowered the price. I put it in $15 price tag on it, but now Amazon's got it down to $7.21.
So, a bargain.
So it's a bargain. And for those who are too impoverished to come up with $7.21, it's also available through the Chicago Public Library. They got a couple copies on file.
Well, you better turn in your copies because people want to read this book. John, can we talk a little bit? Jeff, do we have time to talk a little bit about the writing? Because there are elements of this book, like from a writer's perspective, you see it and you're like, oh man, you know, like the kind of thing I would react when I read like an Anne Keegan story. And you know what? Basically, I'm sure John may have edited some of her stuff.
Oh, she sat right next to me. She was a great writer and a great reporter, and gone too soon.
And merciless when she wanted to go after you. I'll tell this story once. I got a suit because I was embarrassed by not having a suit. So I went down to Bigsby and Crothers, and I should have got a Brooks Brothers style suit. But she took one look at me and she said, "Nathan Detroit comes to the Tribune." And I thought, oh, boy. I knew I would never live it down, and she never stopped saying it, you know?
Wow. Yeah.
All right, let's get to the book.
Yeah, to the book. I mean, it's part of the it's called a Mike Halloran detective novel. So you, when you were writing this book, it sounds like you had like a trilogy in mind, or like at least a whole universe developed. And from what John and is talking, you guys have talked about so far, it sounds like you got a lot of material to grift through. And so what really sparked? I mean, what was the impetus? What's the image in your head when you started to sit down to write this?
Well, really, the image in my head was to go after George Ryan and the clemency hearings and what a travesty it was. I sat down shortly after those hearings were over, I sat down in my basement, and after dinner, I pounded out 2 or 3 hours worth of stuff, and I did that for about 3 months. And I pounded out about 190,000 words, which is almost three times the length of this book. And then it sat there because I tried to get it published through the agents in New York, and they yawned at it. And 2 out of maybe 65 replied with one sentence denials. And so it sat on a flash drive for 13 or 14 years. And I was talking to a fellow ex-Tribune guy, Jim Elsner, who had written about his experience in Camp Lejeune as a Marine and then his time in Vietnam. And he told me about, you know, how he had self-published. And I said, what would that cost you? He said, $1,200. Now, I priced it out way back when at like $7,000-$8,000, and my ego wasn't that big, so I took a pass on it. But I thought, $700, I can handle that. So I contacted his guys, and then I started chopping at this thing. I went to vacation in Mexico, and I sat down at the computer, and I chopped 195,000 words down to 70,000, and you know, threw chapters over my shoulders, got rid of them. But then I had to go back and edit myself to make sure, you know, John, that you didn't.
Painful.
Yeah. It's painful, but you also don't want to, you know, get rid of some person that you refer to later. So it was painful, but it was in the end, I had Ross Werlin, former Tribune editor, edit the book, and who's a crack copy editor, and then Elsner, they both edited it, and then I turned it over to the publishers, and I wasn't expecting a lot, but I got my money back, and I connected with a lot of old friends that I hadn't heard of for 50 years or more. It was very cool.
Ed, you probably also have heard from readers, and I'm telling you, if just as a reader alone, when your descriptions of the life of being a police officer involved in crime stories, the brutalization of the environment, I don't know, it's like the desensitization of people.
Yeah.
And it's just, and the depictions of the morgue, like the, what was the name, or the weird medical examiner?
Dax Stein?
Stein, yeah. I'm sorry, I'm going into stories that I shouldn't probably mention on the air about stuff he collected. But yeah, it was just amazing. And you brought all that back to life at a time when you're speaking of one governor releasing all these killers and springing them from death row. And right now we have another force in Illinois, in Chicago and Cook County, where the governor and the state's attorney are hell-bent on reducing the number of people in the jails. Until we don't have any more jails, no more people, no more criminals.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, John, when I talk about the morgue, the late Nancy Jones, she was the medical examiner for maybe a dozen years or so in Chicago. She also did some cases up in Lake County. And I'd seen her testify in the Lake County case, and I thought she was really good and impregnable from the defense attorneys. So I went and interviewed her at the morgue, and that's where I got the
character,
the door, the smell, and a lot of the logistics on what I'm talking about, medical things. She was She was very helpful. But, you know, it was the 2016 California stuff that I'd seen firsthand as a reporter and then as the secretary for Devine, that, you know, I drew from all of that to slip it into the book.
Sean, so seeing you have a background in, you know, being in the state's attorney's office, and I assume you still follow the news, as it's hard to get that out of your blood. What has been your reaction in the last few years, or your gut instinct on some of the stories you've seen come out of the state's attorney's office? Not necessarily the crime stuff, but the dysfunction, the Kim Fox stuff, the mass exodus, the weird policy changes. I mean, how would you have dealt with some of that, or even what would that have impact on you been back in the day?
Well, there is such a contrast between Kim Fox and Dick Devine, the backgrounds, the way of approaching things. I was with him. He was in office for 12 years, and I was with him for 9.5 of those years. And it was funny because I'd known Dick since grammar school. He lived a block away from me in Edgewater, and he was my ride to school when I was a sophomore. And with that background, Dick was the attorney making lawyerly decisions, mm-hmm. and I was the reporter or ex-reporter trying to figure out what to do with these stories that were flowing out of the state attorney's office. And I got to say that in all those years, I never was in conflict with Dick over any lawyerly decision he made. It doesn't mean that we agreed on everything because two different people, two different ideas.
Right.
But he was pretty Pope-like. He was really made very, very, very few bad decisions. It's not for everyone. And, you know, Kim's on her way out, and now we're looking at a new person coming in. And March 19th, we've got a primary coming up, and Choices to be made between Clayton Harris and Eileen O'Neill Burke. It's a big. You know, everybody's talking about Trump and Biden, but that's a big vote coming up too.
Sure.
On state's attorney.
Very important. What would you say? I mean, being in that position, obviously, you're not the end all, you know, arbiter of what's a good state's attorney. But what do you think? I mean, the personality wise, I mean, I know policy is a thing that it's hard to get around because you never know. But what do you think a good leader in that position should have? What should people look out for between these two candidates?
Well, I think you look at their background, and it's funny. I watched the debate that was on Channel 7 a week or so ago, and the two of them were talking about restorative justice.
Yeah.
And Harris said, well, we've got to spread the restorative justice down to the juvenile level because the kids deserve a break, too. And I'm sitting there and I'm shouting at the television, the Juvenile Justice Reform Act, 1998, Dick Devine pushed it through. It was initially brought in for the juveniles, and it was initiated by Dick 25 years ago. And he's saying, like, oh, well, let's spread it to the juveniles. That's where it began, and it's still been going on for 25 right. years. And he thinks that now he's going to spread it down to the juveniles. It was appalling.
Oh, so clearly knowing the history of the place is important because.
Well, there's one thing I think that many of us miss is that there's a cadre of people that love the office, that love what it does. Understand that it's like they're warrior priests, and the leaders, the political guys come and go, they change, but there has always been a cadre of coppers, of state's attorneys that know that bad guys have to be pulled off the streets, and they're put together in ways that we can't even understand, and when crap hits the fan, there's always a crew that gets sent out there to do what has to be done and get the bad guy. And I think that we're losing them because not you and me and Jeff, but they're being broken because they can't deal with the institution anymore. And that's, to me, the great crime of our politic in Cook County.
You're right about the great cadre of former, obviously former cops, but also former assistant state attorneys.
Yeah.
I was there. There was a turnover rate of about 8% a year. So 8% of about 800 attorneys, you get 64 people leaving every year. And that's been going on forever. I mean, there's people that are my age that are former assistant state attorneys. And it's like people who started out together at City News or people who started out in high school together or grammar school. There is that cadre and that loyalty, and it's a powerful group of people.
Well, we have Mike Halloran, 6'5", I just see him as a guy with a pink ham with a broken nose on the end of it, and there's the beautiful Mrs. Ortiz, his partner. Okay, what's going to happen? Who's going to play them in the movie? Because when we write stuff, we got to think about TV now and movies. So who's going to play it?
Yeah, I could dream about that, but the tall actor who was in the Wedding Crashers, Vince Vaughn, who is a local guy, he went to Lake Forest High School. So he's a local guy and he's a big guy and he's very versatile. I could see him playing Halloran. And, as far as Halloran's mate, Miss Egan, you know, there's a plethora of good looking, actresses who could play her.
Yeah. I think you could go with Michelle Moynihan, but I'm not going to cast your own movie.
That's a good one.
Well, I hope you'll come back and talk about that and other issues facing the prosecutor's office in Chicago and Cook County. You're all always welcome.
Yeah, Jan, love to have you. Where can people find you if they want to track you down? You have just at the back of the book, I guess, or is there a handle you use on Twitter?
If you owe people money, where do they go? Yeah,
exactly.
Well, I've recently moved from Chicago to Hinsdale to be closer to my grandchildren and, frankly, to get away from some of the crime that was around when I lived at, surprisingly, Lakeshore Drive and Grace Street, which you think would be kind of a quiet neighborhood. Sure. It turned out not to be so quiet. So, yeah, I'm out in Hinsdale now. I'm not hiding from anybody.
Well, just take Ogden out to Cass Avenue, Westmont, and drop in to a place called Katie's Dumpling House. Oh. It's right out of Chinatown. It's really authentic food and great dumplings.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, people can find you on Twitter too at JohnGorman541. So that if they can keep their eyes there for the next announcement of the next book. So
yeah, that's great. Hey, listen, it's great talking to you guys. And John, I was telling Jeff earlier that I followed your career with great interest because I was the first guy to talk to you at the Tribune. But you had a hell of a career there. Your writing is enviable.
You're so kind, but I never thought, I never feel worthy enough to talk about this stuff, and especially with professionals that I respect, like true pros like yourself and Garrett and people like that. I just want to say it was my honor, my pleasure and my honor to work with people at the paper that really loved the institution of the paper. And yeah, no matter what's happened to it since then, I'll always have that. So thank you. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thanks, John.
Nice talking to you guys.
See you, man. For John Gorman, former city editor of the Chicago Tribune, the first guy that met me at work, and spokesman for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office for 10 years after that, and now a novelist. Death Before Life is his book. Go get it and get the next one, a Mike Halloran detective novel. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, my friend, future physics leader, teacher, and friend of Katz. And me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of John Cass News, where you always get a good cup of common sense. Thanks for joining us, and join us again next time, won't you, on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.